Welcome to Real Career Talk. I'm your host, Phil Paquette. This is a monthly podcast that's being brought to you by the Network Black Integrated Communication Professionals. We're going to spend about an hour each month sharing a cup of coffee and talking with experts, internal and external, about career hot topics, including talent development pillars for 2020, our emotional intelligence, education, skills development, and even networking. I'm honored to introduce our first guest, Dr. Tina Opie. She has more than 20 years of experience as a thought leader who combines practice and theory to generate high-impact solutions that unleash the power of authenticity in organizations. She is an associate professor of management at Babson College. She is a visiting associate professor at MIT. She's an award-winning researcher and teacher where they explore the connections between diversity, inclusion, and equity, along with identity, culture, fashion, authenticity, and professionalism. Her work was shared on, Shared Sisterhood provides individuals and organizational leaders with specific strategies to tap into authentic identities, forge deeper relationships across differences, and creating even more inclusive work environments. Her work has appeared in the Old Magazine, the Washington Post, Boston Globe, and even the Harvard Business Review. And it goes on and on. Your accolades continue. We welcome you, Dr. Tina Opie. Good morning.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Phil. Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be with you all.
Well, it is a privilege and an honor as well. I'm ready to dive right into our discussion. Got some questions for you. First, I want to ask you, sharing a cup of coffee with me this morning, right?
Well, so what's interesting is I'm going to have some coffee. Normally, I'm going to have some oat milk coffee. I don't know. Many people in our community are lactose intolerant, and this might not be the way that you want to kick off the call, but I am very authentic, and one of the things that LaTanya mentioned you all might want to talk about is self-care as well. So I have found this wonderful cold brew coffee that's made with oat milk. I won't give the brand because I'm not working for them, but let's just say it has allowed me to get in my caffeine, and it has changed my life for the better.
Oat milk is that what this is called? Oat milk. I've never heard this.
Oat milk. So it's literally a matter of using oats, the grain, to make a milk product, and then you add really good strong coffee, and it has a drizzle of caramel in it. I'm telling you, it's life changing. If you want me to, I can tell you after the call what I'm talking about. But I drink one a day.
You know, I was looking for it to be a life-changing impacting discussion. You've already met that, objective, and I'm just... All right. So let's get right into it. Let's get right into it, Dr. Opie. Let's talk about, first of all, emotional intelligence. My question to you is, what does a lack of emotional intelligence actually look like to you and the impact that it can have in our workplace environment?
Yes. So first, let's start off with the definition, because when I have conversations like this, I find that sometimes people are confused or having disagreement because we start with a different baseline definition. And the first thing I'd say is emotional intelligence is how aware of and how well we manage our emotions and the emotions of others. So a lack of emotional intelligence could range from a lack of self-awareness. So for example, maybe I'm not recognizing that I'm frustrated, or I might not recognize what triggers frustration in me. So it can go from a lack of self-awareness to a lack of self-management. So that might be I just have outbursts of a yell when I'm frustrated. So I'm unable to manage my emotions, and I just have these outbursts. So that's in terms of self-awareness and self-management, what a lack of those two skills would look like. In terms of other awareness and sort of influence or other management, other awareness might look like you not recognizing that your coworker's frustrated. So you walk into their office and you start joking about the weather or what happened in the news, and you don't recognize that the person has a frown on their face, that they are leaning over, that maybe they're crying. You might not even be aware of the signals that they're sending to you, that maybe you need to pause and sort of investigate. And then finally, other management or influence is, or lack of influence might be your inability to manage relationships with other people. You might actually cause the situation to worsen with them in such a way that you're really minimizing your ability to influence them in the way that you would like to see them behave. So does that answer your question, Phil?
Most definitely. So when you think about emotional intelligence, and we're talking about being able to understand where I am, what are some of the things that I can do to raise my awareness and become more in tune with, as you stated, that yell that's about to come out? What can I do when I can really stay focused with that? What are some of the indicators that you try to identify?
Right. So I would say one of the key things is to engage in introspection and to really reflect on what you're feeling. And in order to do that, you have to slow down. You have to pause and you have to reflect. So really try to identify the actual emotional sensation that you're having. And what's interesting, Phil, is that there have been times in my life where I didn't know what I was feeling. I knew that I was supposed to be happy that this particular professional outcome, I'd reached that hurdle, but I actually didn't feel happy. I felt sort of depressed or sad. It felt anticlimactic. Or, I personally struggle with depression and have to, I live in New England, and so I have what's called a happy lamp, where it sheds UVA and UVB light on me so that during the really long winter months, I don't get depressed, because that sort of masks my emotions. So the first thing is really to sit down and pause and to be honest with yourself and try to excavate whatever emotions you may be having. Then ask yourself why. Try to figure out what triggered the emotion. What is the emotion tied to? And research and personal experience says it's whenever I have a strong emotion, it's often tied to what psychological research talks about as belonging, competence, or autonomy. So, these are sort of core human needs that we have. We want to feel connected. Competence, we want to feel that we know what we're talking about. And autonomy, we want to have some level of independence and freedom. And when one of those needs is thwarted, we may have deep emotional responses. So for me, the introspection is critical to first figure out what you're feeling and then why you're feeling it, and then try to take it back to what actually may be rooted, what that emotion may be rooted in. And then what I find is I will also talk to other people who know me well. So I have an accountability partner. I have a group of girlfriends I've had since I was one of them since I was a freshman in high school. So I've known her for 30 years. Right. We have different personalities. We're similar in some ways and very different in others. And there'll be times where I'll say, okay, please read this email. Help me make sure that I'm on the right page, in terms of the tone that I want to send out. Is it professional? So what I'm saying there is, to prevent me from potentially exacerbating a situation, I know that I need to surround myself with individuals who balance out my strengths and weaknesses. And so I am humble enough to go to them proactively and say, please look at this email, or I'm thinking about going into my supervisor's office and having this conversation, or going to my coworker because something happened and I want to resolve this conflict. But talking to people and surrounding yourself with people who will be honest and that you can trust is a critical part of developing your emotional intelligence as well.
I want to touch on a couple of things that you stated. One of the words I like to add to discussion is value. That person, yes, that's valued. And unfortunately, in our arena, we can see where people automatically, that's what they tie into. They want to feel heard, as you stated. They want to feel they're understood, and they also want to feel that they're valued, not agreed with, but a value. You have some value to what they're saying. You're feeling that what they had to say was of value. So, question for you that I have for you then in regards to that, when you're talking about that, talk to me about generational differences, because, you know, it seems to me, and I'm just going to go there with you, Doc. It seems like our generations, the Gen Zers and the millennials, are so sensitive. That's what I hear the baby boomers say. Everyone's so sensitive and touchy now. And I haven't heard so many folks talk about being depressed than I hear now. You know, can you talk to me about that just for a few moments? I'm interested.
Right. And are you referring to me when I said that I was depressed, or are you talking about something in general?
Just in general. No. Just in general. Go ahead.
Okay. So it's interesting because I vacillate between two schools of thoughts on sort of generational differences. So one school of thought is this may be shocking, but if you do research on baby boomers, Gen X, Gen Z, you'll see that originated from marketers who were trying to figure out ways to market products and services to individuals in a way that felt more specific to them. So it's not necessarily based in empirical evidence. You know, if you're born in 1968 or 67, I think it is, versus I was born in 1971, are we really that different, even though we're technically in different generations? So that's just something to keep in mind. So I think what I would say is that there could be distinctions between generations, but we need to be mindful about how the labeling of generations even came out to be. That's the first thing. And that's just my researcher hat. The second thing is I have worked in the classroom with, you know, different generations of students, and they're very similar. Many first year students that I've had are earnest. They want to do well in the classroom. They want to perform. When I've had sort of the biggest challenges with students, it has not been about generation. It's been more, I think, about people who may have been exposed to a particular lifestyle where they felt entitled. There were some class challenges sometimes that we had where, you know, literally I've worked in some places where people might miss an exam because they needed to meet their interior designer at their home. And so that was a shock to me. Yes. Yeah. I mean, yes. But I would also say that some of the best students I've had have been from, you know, have been from all different kinds of socioeconomic backgrounds. So my point is not that higher socioeconomic background leads to poor performance in the classroom, but it's just that some of the values, as you say, Phil, some of the expectations that students may have of their professors, excuse me, and then in the workplace, some of the expectations that employees may have of the employer, may be due to other backgrounds, so class, exposure to the professional arena, et cetera. Now, so the last school of thought is that I'm raising teenagers right now. And I'm like, you have no idea. If I said that to my mother or my father, that would not go well. I can't say what I want to say because this is going to be broadcast publicly.
Right.
But it's exactly. Old school. Yeah, I might have chiclets in my mouth. That's all I'll say. I might not have teeth. But so I do feel as though there are some values. You know, one of the things that we're seeing is that employees used to stay at organizations for decades. They would start a job and they would retire from that job. I think now the average tenure of employees is 4 to 5 years, and people have major career shifts and changes. And so I think employers interpret that to mean that employees are not as loyal, that they will leave. But in that same time period, pensions have gone away. Things like insurance costs relative to the salaries have increased. Some people are saying that organizations are demanding more and more of their employees and they are paying less. So given the convergence of those different phenomena, sort of on the employee side and on the employer side, that lack of loyalty may, again, not be due to generations. It may be due to some other factors. So for, I don't know if that quite got at what you were going for, but I really think that if we so one of the reasons why I resist labeling it as a generational issue is that once you've done that, it sort of shuts the conversation down because you're saying they're from a different generation. So they're entitled. They don't get it. They don't understand. What I find is much more helpful is to try to understand what is underneath that attitude. What is the value? Is it that they really don't want to do the work? And that could be the case because I've had some instances like that. Or is it that they think there is a better path to get the work done, which can also be difficult to hear because you're like, look, you just got here. You're still wet behind the ears and you're now trying to give direction and guidance to people who are more senior. But isn't that part of the reason why we value diversity and inclusion, to hear different perspectives and opinions to refine the way that we do work in the workplace? So I think this sense of generational disdain is sometimes unwarranted and might be better addressed with really listening to what the employees are saying.
I love the last point, listening to understand as opposed to listening to be heard. So I appreciate that. When you think about emotional intelligence, I wanted to get your take on how generationally it might waver or differ. And from what I'm getting, we're kind of like of the same mold in a sense. But we say, if you really want to understand a person, see the era in which they were raised, right? Could that have a tap into how our emotional intelligence might show so much differently depending on that difference? You know, to your point, you just made the point, hey, listen, if I said some of the things that these young people say today to our parents, I was in that same type of household, old school, we like to say, I think the darkness would come over me, you know, the darkness. And then I wake up, you know, and then I wake up.
Exactly. The darkness came over you and then you saw the light.
All right. This is phenomenal. So to wrap up this segment, so what do we need to do to gain emotion? What do you think that we can do? No matter who we're talking about, what can we do to gain emotional intelligence? We see how critical it is to be able to be aware of our emotions, as you stated, and also raising our awareness of others and how they're responding in that moment. So what can we do?
Yeah, so I'll go back to the earlier point I raised about introspection. So I'll focus on first the self. So the introspection piece is critical to examine what you're feeling and why you're feeling it, and how, and what deeper need or value that might be connected to. Surrounding yourself also with people who can hold you accountable, who may have different strengths and weaknesses than you do. In terms of other awareness, I stated this, listening. So, you know, my parents would probably say that I let my children talk too much because I was raised differently, where children, you respected your elders and you did what you were told within reason, obviously. Nowadays, I think because of and this is a generational difference, because of the onset of social media and how fast things are, Twitter, Instagram, and the fact that social media is a largely equalizing force, so that people feel like they have a right to share their two cents, to voice their concerns or their thoughts. I think this is a culture that is more accustomed to being heard. Yeah. And so that is, I think, a difference. And it's not necessarily genetic. It's not, you know, in terms of generational, I think it's because of the time cohort effect, where this group is growing up with just literally more access at their fingertips to communicate what they think and say. So in terms of gaining more emotional intelligence on that other column, so in terms of other awareness and other management or influence or empathy, I think it's important to listen. One of the things that I like to do, I'm the faculty advisor for the Black Student Union at my college, and listening to the students, they have sometimes very different ideas about how to proceed on something. And I think my emotional intelligence is increased by understanding their perspective. And that does not, and listening does not mean that you change course 100%, but it does mean that you give voice to people who may disagree with you. And there's also research on employee voice, which shows that even when an organization may make a decision that employees disagree with, the employees are more likely to accept that opinion when they feel like they have been heard, when they've been able to voice their opinion. And so the perception of the supervisors and the organization is more positive. And if I were to now take that down to the individual level, the perception of me as a supervisor will be that my emotional intelligence is higher if I develop the skill of listening and sincerely listening to what my employees are saying. So I think those are some of the steps that I would suggest that people consider when they're trying to develop or hone their emotional intelligence.
I think this is powerful, and I appreciate that insight. So one of the skill sets that we all have the capacity to grow, which is the art of listening. That's powerful. So I got a question for you. I'm going to switch our topic here, and I want to get into the next few moments, education and skills development. So we have seen a switch in corporate America now. We see baby boomers now settling into the possibility of retirement. We see those same generations, the newer generations, moving into corporate America. We see Gen Zers coming in. We see millennials fighting for, and don't forget the Xers. So my question to you then is how important is it growing up in our era? We knew you had to have a diploma. So how important is it having a degree now? And I want you to tap into the next portion of that is for those of us that have the degree, then what's essential about continuous learning? What's important about
continuous
required? Okay.
Okay, so that's a great. So having a degree, and so there are different schools of thought. And I'm going to start with the least common, which is, okay, a degree is not necessary. So there are articles, I'm going to come back with an alternative perspective just to try to get listeners in. And this is probably pretty controversial because I'm a college professor. Okay. So there are articles out there that say that plumbers and electricians and other fields of study fields of work where they make close to six figures without a degree. And so if that is your goal, to make six figures, then that might be a quicker path to get to that. Now, the question that I have, so I'm sort of revealing my personal perspective when I say this, when ask yourself if you want to be a plumber or electrician when you're older. If that is your source of income and it involves manual labor or just you're in a particular field of work. And the reason I bring up manual labor is I have family members who are older. They're in their 60s and 70s, proud men, bricklayers. It has become increasingly more difficult for them to support themselves as they age. And I think that that is something that I want individuals to consider. Because if you have only worked in one field, your options might not be that huge if you don't have a degree. Now, obviously, I'm revealing a big bias, and I don't know if you all have people who can write in or call in during this interview, but I am biased towards college, and my husband and I actually differ on this with our children, but I think that you gain more than access to money when you go to college. And when I'm sharing my personal story with people, I say that I learned so much about myself in college. Outside of the classroom is when most of my learning happened. So in the dorms, living with people from different cultures for the first time, learning to deal with conflict across culture, balancing a budget. Now, some of these things happen outside of college, whether or not you know, college is not a requirement. But let's go back to the plumbers and electricians. let's say that they do really well and they want to grow. They want to get more clients. They want to hire employees.
Right.
Is it a given that hands-on training will help you manage that growth or know how to motivate people? Now, I'm not saying that college graduates know how to do this immediately or even after they graduate, but I do think that certain education, so this is not a plug, but it sort of is, but the kind of education that we give, it's an entrepreneurial education at Babson College, can help. So just yesterday, I had lunch with one of my former students who shared that the kind of experience that she gained when I was her professor in our Foundations of Management and Entrepreneurship class, it helped her see connections between finance, marketing, and accounting that some of her other college-educated team members couldn't see. So to me, it suggests a different question, that it's not about necessarily only if you get a college degree or not. It's about the type of education and the exposure that you get. And so maybe you don't go to college, but from day one, you strategize about how else you can collect the experiences that you need to accomplish your goals. And then one last caveat. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. One last caveat is that in some fields, you need a degree to get in the door. So if you want, and you know, there may be exceptions to the rule, but if you want to be an investment banker or a management consultant, you need a college degree. And if you want to be a tenure track professor, you need an advanced degree. But outside, you know, there are some opportunities and some avenues, and there are some very successful people. And by success, I don't just mean money, because I think that's another problem with our society, is that we measure people's success by money. I want to know, what is your health like? How do you treat other people? What's your legacy? If you die, would people even think of you? Would they miss you? Or would they just say, he made a lot of money or she made a lot of money, but they were a jerk? So I think it's important that as a society, we broaden our conception of what is and is not success. And we then evaluate college education accordingly. You asked a second question, but I can pause if you have any reactions. Yes, I do.
So I want to add another word, success and prestige. Well, you say we judge based on what success looks like based on money and prestige. Can we say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do that. So you have some people who say, well, I don't need a degree, but I can go get it. To your point, if I want to be a plumber, I need to go and I can get a license. I can get a certification. So talk to me a little bit about how do we weigh that? I had a leader tell me once, Phil, if you don't have a degree, I just throw your application in the waste, in the trash. You don't have a degree. I had another leader tell me, well, Phil, you know, to obtain a degree shows that you have the wherewithal to complete an initiative or an objective. Another reason why they identified that if you don't have a degree, I really wonder, can you complete a task? You know, can you complete something? So, go ahead. Interested in your thoughts on this.
Well, that doesn't strike me the right way. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are people who, I mean, my mother has an associate's degree. She doesn't have a bachelor's degree. So there's nobody more hardworking. This is a woman. My mother, I mean, she picked cotton in Georgia. And people say, you're mistaken, right? Not your mother, your grandmother. No, my mother, her family were sharecroppers. She picked cotton in Pinehurst, Georgia. She moved to St. Petersburg, Florida, and went to integrated schools for part of the time, and part of the time they were segregated. She joined the Marines, yes, back in the day when there were hardly any women in the Marines, and got married, became a homemaker. And when she got her associate's degree, and then being a full-time mom mattered. I mean, that was where she focused her time. And so she never got a bachelor's degree, but she has worked hard. She complete a task. I mean, the people who are saying that you have to have a college degree to evidence your ability to complete a task, I would ask them to do homemaking for a month. You have to do a lot of different things. And this is just a particular case of my mother. And I think that that does influence my answer to this question. I think, honestly, the college degree is valuable, as I just shared, but it all too often is used as a shortcut to determine someone's worth, to assess their personality. In other words, we sometimes stereotype people because they do or do not have a college degree. Part of the reason I think we do that is because organizations receive so many applications for these positions that a college degree is an easy yes or no question. It's a binary. Either you have it or you don't.
Right.
But I definitely think that organizations may be overlooking a lot of talent. A lot of talent because people don't have a degree. Now, I do think so to me, what that suggests is that interviews should be behavioral in nature, where you can sort of get at the actual tasks and skills and strategies that people need. Now, remember, my husband and I disagree on this. I actually think college degrees are valuable.
Sure.
So when you're making the decision not to go to college, just recognize that there may be negative consequences down the road. And the other thing I'd say is it's sort of unfair to equate college degree with the ability to complete a task, given how expensive college educations are. So there's a built-in sort of class issue with this discussion as well, because there are many people who are at the top of their class, who are hardworking, who are not able to go to college because they can't afford it. So I think we have to make sure that we're not overlooking talent because we don't have a better way to assess it.
Excellent point. So let's switch and talk about continuous learning. And I want you to answer this question. Is it required? So I want you to answer it. So you have a young person that just completed school, talking about finances, talking about the issues with finances and what it costs to complete that degree. But now the platform, the horizon is changed in this regard. A degree by itself is really not competitive. It's not going to make you competitive in the workplace today. Unfortunately, we have heard this coming out. You need a master's. So talk to me from the point of that individual that just completed school, and now he's looking at, should I continue? He or she is looking at, should I continue and move forward? How essential, how important is it? And then I want you to flip and talk about the person that's got 30 years in the business, 20, 30 years in the business, and he's looking at this horizon of, you know, you need to continuously develop. You need to, and we hear that in corporate speak quite a bit now. You should be always looking to continuously develop yourself if that looks like going back to school, if that looks like tapping in, taking a trade, getting a nano degree. Talk to me about that real quick in both of them.
Okay. So to the person who just finished their degree and they're told that they may now need a master's. So this may be too much personal information, but I would say stop, drop and roll. Look, are you in debt? Do you already have a ton of undergraduate degree debt? And if you do, the personal information is my husband and I, we live debt free. So we have a mortgage that we're quickly paying off, but we don't use credit cards. We buy cars with cash. We travel with cash. And I know there's finance professionals listening who are saying, oh my goodness, but you're going to lose out on the points. Well, you have to ask yourself, why is it that an entire industry is incenting people to use their product with points? It's because all it takes is you missing one paycheck and not paying the bill when you're supposed to, and you lose those points. And now you're paying back an interest rate that is ridiculously high. So there's a reason why credit card companies provide points. And if you live with cash, you don't need it. I don't need them. So that's an aside. But this speaks to a philosophy or a value that I have. For me, education should be about freedom. It should be about access. And if you lose your freedom and you lose your access to live the kind of life that you want to because you have to work in order to pay off the debt you incurred to get the education, I think you have to ask, what exactly is your priority? What is your priority? So while a master's degree could be necessary in someone's mind, I ask them why. Why do you need it? And I think organizations have to be careful about contributing to this. If you are telling young people you have to have a master's degree to perform well in this role, is that really true? And again, I have an MBA and I have a PhD, so I love education. Some of my friends joke, they're like, girl, when are you going to get a real job? Go to work. You've been in school for years. So I am perhaps someone who people might think it is ironic that I'm sharing this point, but I really do think you need to pause. And the reason I got an MBA was because I wanted to get into consulting at a particular level. And in order to do that, you needed an MBA. But my MBA, because of my grades and the program, it was paid for me. That's a very different decision than entering into a $60,000 per year debt situation. So I think what I'm trying to say, Phil, is that education can sometimes be a lure to a better life, but you really need to pause and ask your, or I should say higher education, formal education, because in my opinion, everybody should always be educating themselves. I am constantly reading. My husband reads books, audiobooks, listens to podcasts. We are voracious readers in our family. We go to conferences. We talk to people who are smarter than us. We watch, you know, historical films. So there's ways to educate yourself that are not necessarily formal, but that can keep you up to date on some of the things that are happening in your field and in the world. And that is what I think we need to also consider when we are talking about being educated. So there's formal and informal education. In terms of continuous development, for the person who's been in the career for 30 years, you will have some experiential learning that you get from the day-to-day doing of your work. I do think that it is important every so often to maybe go to a conference, to talk, to make sure that you stay attuned. And we're going to talk about networking, I'm sure. Your network will give you sort of an indication. If they're talking about a particular technology or approach that you have no clue about, that's a signal that you may be lagging in terms of your personal development or in professional development, and that you need to address that. Coaching is another way to remain abreast in terms of your professional development. So I have a coach, a productivity coach. I haven't worked with her in a while. I've been super productive. I need to go back to her. But I work with a productivity coach who can, because she is coaching other people in my field, she can keep me apprised of some of the developments that are occurring. And then I can also share some of my ideas with her, and she can help me to refine that. And I've done coaching for executives, one-on-one coaching, where I help them, because of my particular position in the industry, I can help them accomplish goals that they might not be aware of were even important. So anyway, so continuous development is absolutely imperative. I just don't want us to fall into the trap of thinking that formal education is the only form of continuous development, because it's not.
I have a question. I heard something that I want you to tap into. I want to make sure our listeners get it. So you stated, you and your husband, you have an MBA, and you're a teacher in these wonderful schools of learning. However, yet you and your husband make sure that you listen to those that are smarter than you. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Oh, yeah. So I am rarely in a position where I feel like I'm the smartest person in the room all the time from morning to night. I intentionally put myself in situations where I can fail. And I try to have a gut busting belly laugh once a day. I try to cry every day watching something. You know, I like puppies and kittens and little babies, so I watch those videos. And then I try to have a failure. There is something that I will learn that I'm so I'm working and I'm writing. I'm doing, I think I told you, I launched my consulting firm this year, OP Consulting Group. And I try to push myself so that I learn something every day. But that means if you're learning something, I am pushing myself so that I realize, oh my God, I don't know how to answer this question. I have no idea. That means I have to then go out and I may, you know, crowdsource it by saying, hey, does anyone know about such and such and such on Twitter or on Facebook? And then I'll go and I'll do the research on that particular question to educate myself. And then I'll share the information with the individuals who I crowdsource from. That is critical. That is critical. So this also connects to our earlier conversation about emotional intelligence. To the listeners, if you feel embarrassed when you don't know something, if you feel that you have to hide your lack of knowledge about something, how self-confident are you? How resilient are you? Now, there is a caveat, because we do know from research that people from historically underrepresented demographics, so in the workplace, so women, Black people, Latino, Native American, and Asian Americans in senior ranks, there is an additional cost to revealing sort of that you don't understand particular things. So my point is not that you go out and say, oh my goodness, I'm confused, I don't know how to do my job. Mm-hmm. In front of anyone and everyone. But I do think it's important, again, that you have people you surround yourself with who you trust, who are smarter than you, who can help you get better. So please don't hear my advice as saying that you go to your boss any and every day you're confused and say, I don't understand this and I don't know how to do my job. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I have a circle of girlfriends and friends who I trust, who are smarter than me in many ways. And I'll say, listen, I have no idea how to grow my business, or I have no idea how to deal with this client or how to address this financial situation. Can you please educate me? So but I'm not going to go to, I don't have a boss in academia. I'm not going to go to someone who is above me in the hierarchy, who I don't necessarily know, and reveal that information, if that makes sense, Phil.
Well, you know what, and which lets me know that there is a difference. We're talking to our listeners. There's a difference from getting mentored and getting this learning discussion that we're talking about. I believe there's a difference between the two. Would you agree with that?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that when you go, so you have mentors, and then you have advocates. So an advocate is often someone who was within the organization, who behind closed doors can speak on your behalf and go to bat for you. A mentor can be someone who's within the organization or outside of the organization who gives you sort of advice and mentorship that might be related to your job in particular, or it might be related to your life. And then you have... We're sort of segueing into a conversation about networking, because there are going to be certain people in your network who give you advice, some people who give you friendship, other people who give you information or task-related performance information, and those might not be the same people, and probably they shouldn't be, because you want to get a diversity of perspectives so that you can triangulate on the best path forward that you might want to take. But I agree with you, Phil. So mentorship and continuous development and learning are not necessarily the same thing, although a mentor might help point you in the direction of something or someone that can help you learn.
Love that. And you know what? You just tapped into what we're going into next. It is a segue into networking, and we really want to get into in our last segment, which is all about networking, the importance, the significance of networking. How essential is it? Is it really critical? And what are some do's and don'ts when it comes to networking? Let's talk about that.
Sure. So yes, I do believe that networking is essential for success in the workplace and in life in general. I mean, networking is really, it's a connection of relationships in which you are embedded. And those connections facilitate the exchange of friendship, information, ideas, advice. And I've actually written a paper, co-authored a paper on this in 2017. And it's a journal article in Organizational Dynamics. And we can talk off line about making sure that you all have a link to access that article. Mm-hmm. But that article talks about the importance of networking. And I think it's important that your listeners, we sometimes need to stop thinking of networking as a necessary evil. We think, oh gosh, I really and truly don't want to go to this networking event. It is such a pain. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes people have that perspective because they think of it as they're going out and they're asking other people for help and they're trying to find a job and it feels like a burden. And I try to frame it as an opportunity to connect with interesting people mm-hmm. who I want to learn from and to whom I might be able to share some helpful information. So it's not just about me taking. Before I go to a networking event, I think about what are some of the unique things about me that might be of interest to this particular audience. And that will shift depending upon the audience. So, you know, I was a former banker, I was a former management consultant, and now I have my own consulting firm, and I'm a professor. I'm also a mother, a wife, I'm a Christian woman. I've taught at my church and in our women's meetup. So there's a variety of skills and experiences that I have that might be of interest to other people. But I've first done that thinking. I also may, if I know where I'm networking, I will do research on who's going to be there. So, you know, Phil, I know that you work with Aspire with the Steve Harvey Foundation, right? So I would do that research before you and I talk on the phone, because you might say, oh, the Steve and Marjorie, I need to give credit to Marjorie. She's fabulous. But yeah, it's important to do sort of that work. And then when you get there, when you get there, I tend to, you need to understand what your own style is. I actually hate networking events where I walk into this big ballroom and there's 3,000 people in the room and it's loud and I can't really hear myself. So what I do is I will often go with other people and we will sort of sweep the room and we will walk through the room and we'll identify who's there. And then we end up having a series, sequential conversations with three or four people. Because for me, I don't like surface level, superficial conversations. And when I think about networking, that's often what I think about. Where, hey, how are you? Oh, you're a Babson. Okay, great. I was interested in doing that. Okay, great. I'll see you later. To me, that's not very helpful. But when we can have a longer conversation and actually engage in information exchange, advice exchange, maybe even share a joke with each other and remember each other's names that way, that's very helpful. So then when an opportunity comes up at my institution, I may say, oh, I met such and such and such, and they said they were interested in this. I'm going to send them the job posting with a personalized note that references our interaction. That just feels very different to me than going into a big ballroom and just sort of sporadically and superficially speaking to individuals.
I want to jump in there real quick, Doctor. You say, so what I hear you alluding to is being authentic.
Yes.
Authentic.
Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, it's authentic. And so being authentic is about revealing who you are. It's also being uniquely interested in understanding the other person's authentic self. So it's authenticity of the self as well as other, where I'm trying to have an authentic moment of connection with you, not something where, you know, every single person in here could probably ask about this particular thing of you. Where did you go to school? Who cares? That people might be thinking of that as an entry point because maybe we know people in common. But often I find, you know, oh my goodness, this is so interesting. I've been asking people, what's the last movie you saw? Or what book have you read? And then I can figure out how to dovetail or connect that to the work. But that might help people feel like there's a more authentic connection.
So one of my final questions that I have for you. So, okay, so I'm in this room. Now, I just want you to know, just off, you know, sidebar note here, making the one comment of learning from others and being powerful and authentic. I agree. I love the comment earlier. You said sometimes you need to stop. What did you say earlier? You said stop, drop, and roll. You know, stop, drop, and roll. You know, I'm taking that home. I'm going to share that. Babe, we got to stop, drop, and roll here. All right, so
and it's because it's like your finances might be on fire because we keep going into debt, and I'm sorry, debt is bondage, and bondage is the absence of freedom, and I just I can't do it anymore. It took me a while to get to that point, but I will tell you that being debt free has affected the decisions that I make about my work because I don't have to do if I don't want to do it, I don't have to do it. That doesn't mean that I'm not going to be a team player. And, you know, I still have to grade papers, which I don't like. I hate grading papers. I wish we didn't have grades per se. It was more conversations with students. But that's how I've now framed grading. But I think it's finances are a big driver. I mean, if you go back to the initial points we talked about in terms of do you need a college degree, mm-hmm. continuous learning, networking. A lot of those things are tied to our ability to get access to other people and resources. And oftentimes, one of the critical resources is money. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think it can be overstated that if we get our finances in order, we might make very different decisions when we're not living paycheck to paycheck. How can we break that cycle of dependence on things like credit cards and debt so that we have the financial freedom to make decisions that align with our values and our authentic selves. That for me is very much what my work in consulting is all about, is helping people get to that point. And I know we have just a few more minutes, Phil, but I wanted to say mm-hmm. a few things in terms of how you can network and also remain true to your authentic self. So I mentioned, you know, try to frame it as an opportunity to connect authentically with other people and exchange helpful information, advice, friendship, jokes. But one of the things I've noticed is that you need to look at your network. So there is one of my colleagues, one of her advisors when she was in a doctoral program, they're both now, she's a full professor. They developed a networking activity. So you want to look at your network mm-hmm. and you want to assess it. Who do you go to for personal advice? Who do you go to for work advice, for friendship, for information? And you want to, once you write down their names, you want to ask yourself, is your network primarily comprised of people just like you? So are they all from, I grew up in, you know, Alexandria, Virginia. They went to JMU or UVA or NYU. They're black or they're white or they're women or they're men, they're whatever. But research suggests that if you have a relatively homogenous, that is similar network, you may have largely redundant information, meaning a lot of the information in your network, everyone else has. But novel information, which is something that you know that other people don't, increases your level of influence in your network. So it's sort of like when you hear a story, you know, somebody will say, oh my gosh, did you see the video of when that person did blah, blah, blah? And everyone has seen it because we're all in the same network and it went viral. But then there's a person who said, oh my goodness, did you hear this tip that such and such and such and such is happening and nobody else has heard that? All of a sudden, you have something unique about you because you're bringing that information to bear. And one of the ways to get novel information is to bridge disparate networks. So one of the blessings that I've had in my academic career at Babson College is that Babson College had not had, for example, much of a connection to an organization I love, which is the PhD Project. Are you familiar with that, Phil?
I heard about it. Tell me more.
Okay, so I'll just give, this is a plug. I haven't plugged other things, but I'm going to plug this because I love it. So the PhD Project started by someone named Barney Milano, who's at KPMG, and he basically 40 years ago was hiring accountants, recognized, oh my goodness, where are the African-American, the Latin-American, the Native American accountants? And they were told they really don't have PhDs. There are not a lot of them who have PhDs. So he said, we can fix that. So they created this program where I went through it. So I applied to NYU. I get into NYU. As soon as I get in, I'm engrafted into the PhD project. And that means that I get, to your point, professional development. I'm put into this network of people who are already doctoral students and who are faculty. Mm-hmm. And that significantly enhanced my success. But going back to what I was saying before about Babson, Babson is trying to hire talented African-American, Latin-American, and Native American doctoral candidates and professors, as well as others. But they've struggled at how to get that done. So here I come and I say, wait a minute, if this is Babson's goal, the PhD project is a network that might help you bring that to pass. So because of my presence, I'm able to help them connect together. And then our chief diversity officer, Sadie Burton Goss, cements the relationship because she also is part of that network. So that's how networking can work with in terms of novel information. I also want the listeners to network when they're not desperate, if they can.
What does that mean? Tell me what does that mean when they're not
desperate? So you networking when you're desperate may be necessary, but the optimal situation is when do you want to have an umbrella in your car? It's before it starts raining. So networking for me is that umbrella. You want to develop relationships. Network when you have something to offer. You want to develop deeper relationships with people. You want to exchange information. You have a job. You're happy in your job. And you're going to networking events not because you're desperate for a job because you've been unemployed for a year. Now, I'm not saying that if you've been unemployed, you shouldn't network. But what I'm saying is that you should recognize the power dynamics and the effect that that will have on your behavior at the networking events when you are desperate. That's what I'm saying. So, and I think it's important to also say one thing that I don't like is when I only hear from people when they need something from me. So it's sort of, you know, your phone rings, you see the number, you're like, oh, Lord, I know they're going to be asking for something else because it feels disingenuous. And honestly, it can be draining. And it's not that you don't like to help people, but when it feels like someone is coming to you with their hand out constantly, I sort of feel used. And I don't think anyone likes to feel used. So I try not to use other people and think about what do I have to contribute to them. And some of your younger recent college grads may think, I don't have anything to contribute. But my students, some of them first-year college students, they have deep knowledge about things like, I mean, they're finance, technology, music. They have generational viewpoints. What would happen if they took that framing, researched a company where they wanted to work, and applied their general viewpoints to the firm? So, you know, show how you think. Share your insights. Send interesting articles or links to people in fields you'd like to join that they may not have heard of. And actually follow up when someone gives you a card, because I've given my card or my contact information to a lot of people. Oh my goodness, I follow your work. I love your work. They never follow up. And the people who do follow up are surprised with how much time I'll spend with them. So anyway.
Well, Doctor, we are wrapping up. We are wrapping up our session. I believe it has been powerful. One of my taglines I love is impact, influence, and inspire. I think the knowledge that you just shared has been phenomenal, and I think it will be impacting too many in our network group. And I'm going to give you about 30 more seconds in this regard. Tell us what you're doing. Tell us where we can find you. Tell us what you're working on. Real quick, share with us real quick. What are you working on? Where can we find you? A little bit more about Dr. Opie real quick before we wrap up today.
Yes. So I am blessed to be on sabbatical right now. So that's why I'm a visiting associate professor at MIT. I am working on my research, as I mentioned. So I do research on diversity, inclusion, and equity with a focus on authenticity and professionalism. And what does that mean? So I've studied things like natural hair in the workplace, body size, and how people who are often stigmatized can sort of be recognized for their worth so that organizations are able to really proceed and create inclusive climates. I'm also working on something called Shared Sisterhood, which looks at how women and their allies can work together for collective advance for all women. And your gender need not matter. So, Phil, you might become a sister. And that means that you are engaging in authenticity, trust, empathy, and risk-taking for the purpose or the cause of helping women to advance in the workplace. I have also launched my consulting firm, and OP Consulting Group, LLC, and I'm working with several clients. So I've worked with the NFL, UBS, and a couple of other organizations. And so that has been really fun because I'm building the car while I'm driving it. And that requires that I constantly network. But I'm on LinkedIn and Instagram. Please find me there. LinkedIn is probably the best way for people to reach me. And I'm there, listed there as Tina Opie, and then in parentheses, Pittman, P-I-T-T-M-A-N, which is my maiden name. All right. Thank you so much for having me, Phil. This was really amazing, and I hope that it's helpful to your listeners.
Doctor, I thank you. I thank you, Network. We were powerful. Be powerful. Looking forward to seeing you at our next series.